Welcome to Talking Feds, a roundtable that brings together prominent former federal officials and special guests for a dynamic discussion of the most important political and legal topics of the day. I'm Harry Littman. The old Republican Party is defunct, but in terms of a functioning group of legislative initiatives and ideas, it appears to have no successor. Speaker Mike Johnson is now left with the bare minimum majority of exactly one member and a motion to oust him from the rabble-rousing MAGA right. And in the Senate, the succession battles have begun to replace longtime Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. The newly exiled Republican, Liz Cheney, gave a remarkable speech in which she took the Trump-curated Supreme Court to task for its leisurely approach to the Trump immunity appeal, which has put on ice the January 6th trial before Judge Tanya Chutkan. Meanwhile, the court this week heard an abortion case that generated white heat attention, a reminder that the issue is still in the forefront of voters' minds. Elsewhere in Trump criminal land, at least one trial, the voter deception case brought by New York's DA Alvin Bragg, is approaching the runway. After the judge there imposed a gag order on Trump, along the lines of other courts' orders, Trump let loose a remarkably foul, gutter-level attack on the judge and his daughter that seems to invite a further showdown with the court once a jury is selected. To evaluate the challenges in Congress, the Supreme Court, and the state and federal criminal justice systems, and assess their political implications for the November 2024 election, we welcome a great group of sage and seasoned commentators, all returning guests to Talking Feds. And they are: Congressman Jamie Raskin represents Maryland's 8th District in the U.S. House of Representatives. He's the ranking member of the House Committee on Oversight and Accountability. He was the lead impeachment manager in the second impeachment trial of Donald Trump and a member of the January 6th committee. He also was the inaugural guest at Talking San Diego, the speaker series we launched with him last week. Thanks very much for this major helping of Talking Feds Fair, Jamie Raskin.
Delighted to be with you.
Jacob Weisberg, CEO and co-founder of Pushkin Industries. He was previously CEO of The Slate Group, co-founder of Panoply, and editor-in-chief of Slate Magazine. He serves as board chair of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Welcome back to Talking Feds, Jacob Weisberg.
Thanks, Harry.
And Christine Todd Whitman, the president of the Whitman Strategy Group, a consulting firm that specializes in energy and environmental issues. She is co-chair of the Forward Party and co-chair of the state's United Democracy Center. She served in the cabinet of President George W. Bush as administrator of the EPA and served as governor of the state of New Jersey from 1994 until 2001. Welcome back, Christine Todd Whitman.
It's always good to be with you.
So let's start with the Republicans in the House where Congressman Raskin serves. They now have the smallest House majority in decades, and the margin's about to tighten even more when the House returns next month with the resignations of Mike Gallagher and Ken Buck. The GOP majority, I believe, will be reduced to a single vote. And all the while, Speaker Mike Johnson is under challenge of an ouster motion from Marjorie Taylor Greene. So let's start here. What's that going to mean for Johnson and the caucus? Are they going to give up, if to the extent they haven't already, even trying to achieve anything?
Well, they've got no legislative program other than following whatever Donald Trump tells them to do. His program is purely negative. When we actually came up with a complete foreign assistance package that included dramatic breakthroughs in immigration and border legislative policy reforms, Trump blew it up, acting as the fourth branch of government, subservient to the fifth branch of government, Vladimir Putin, who wasn't interested in $61 billion going to the people of Ukraine to fight off his bloodthirsty imperial invasion. So they've got no legislative program. It's an ungovernable situation because they've basically bred their members on insurrectionism and nihilism. And so the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the Matt Gaetzes have every reason to think that they're doing the right thing by blowing up their majority. Now, if they lose one more, we could be in a tie situation where we've got some kind of power sharing arrangement. If they lost a couple, if, you know, somebody decided to change parties, something like that could happen, in which case we would have the chance to get some stuff done. Foremost in our minds right now is getting aid to the people of Ukraine and humanitarian assistance to the suffering people of Gaza and of Ukraine who've just been left out in this nightmare. But we are literally seeing the disintegration of the GOP, and the Christine Todd Whitman Republicans are heading for the exits on a daily basis now.
Well, it's true. I mean, I can't disagree with a thing that you said. There is no Republican Party. There is a cult. It's the cult of Trump. They don't have a program. They don't have a plan. They don't have things that they want to accomplish for the country. They just wait and see what he tells them to do when they do it. I mean, blowing up that piece of legislation that Congressman Raskin referred to was just unconscionable. Because particularly the monies that had been put in there for immigration, I'm right now in Arizona, I want to tell you, it's a big issue out here. And to say we don't want to deal with this issue because we want it for the election, that blatantly, if that doesn't upset people and tell them how our parties have gotten out of control, their ability to control their members, and I'm sorry, Congressman, it's happening on the left a bit too, not as far along as the Republicans, but it's happening on the left, is just unconscionable. And that's why we've started the Forward Party, to build from the grassroots up and to give a home to all those people that are leaving their parties because they're not comfortable with what's going on.
Let me jump over to you, Jacob Weisberg, and maybe you could incorporate what's happening in the Senate. I mean, we talk about the obsolescence or extinction of the Republicans as we knew them a generation ago, like Governor Whitman, and now Mitch McConnell stepping down and you have a battle for his successor. Basically, is there no room at all at the table for traditional Republicans, and not just now, but kind of just like the Whigs now, a total historical vestige?
Looks that way to me. I mean, look, in a healthy political culture, Christine Todd Whitman is a Republican moderate. That's the political world I grew up in. I'm not sure we appreciated it enough at the time. In the actual Republican Party we have now, someone who is not a full-throated election denier is a Republican moderate. Mike Johnson was elected Speaker of the House to be held hostage by people who have even crazier views than he does. In a normal world, he would be the crazy, and Marjorie Taylor Greene would be standing on a soapbox outside of Congress. I do not see, I mean, every hope we've had of Republican moderates reasserting even a presence in the party has been defeated since Trump. And I would like to say that there's some path back, but I really don't see it. And I think Governor Whitman is on the right track to be focused on what's going to come after the Republican Party, because someday Trump's going to be gone. The party's going to be discredited. And I don't know that it will really be possible to reclaim it.
Yes, someday Trump is going to be gone. But you have people certainly trying to be in his image in one way or another. Do you have a sense? Is the end of Trump the end of Trumpism?
No, unfortunately, I don't think it's the end of it. He touched a nerve. I mean, we've got to recognize that. People were frustrated because they didn't feel Congress was addressing their issues, that the things that they care about, especially in the center of the country. I mean, it's been great. Our technology development has been terrific, but it's left a lot of people behind. And we haven't done a lot to help those and support those people. So there's an anger. I don't hate Donald Trump because he isn't worth the effort, but I deplore what he has done to our country, because what he's done is brought out this, it's okay to hate. It's okay to talk about that hatred. It's okay to act on that hatred. In fact, he encourages it in so many different ways. And, you know, the man seems to be Teflon. It doesn't matter what he has done. He seems to get away with it. There are a lot of court cases now that could cause him problems, but just as we saw in the last one, he got his penalty reduced from the $425 million, I guess it was, to $175 million. And maybe he'll come up with that. And it will be dark money. You won't know who gave it to him or where it came from, which I think would be really important to know, because there are people outside this country that are going to be much more comfortable with him as president than they would with anybody else. So it's very frustrating and it's scary. It's a scary time.
It's a great point. I'll just insert a little legal thing. This is mainly not about the ins and outs of the law, but I do think with the monitor appointed, even if you were to choose someone who would have grave consequences for the national interest, I think we will at least know through Barbara Jones. Let's zero back in for a second on Mike Johnson. When you read him on paper and his view, you know, he is, I don't remember a theocrat of such intensity at this level of the government before. But now, a margin of one, Marjorie Taylor Greene looking to oust him. Is he not long for this world? Does he try to just hunker down? Does he make common cause with Dems? Any thoughts about Johnson himself? It's getting to be a little bit like the drummers in Spinal Tap, right? The House Republican speakers.
Well, Mike Johnson said that God put him in there and God might take him out too. I mean, remember, this is the new GOP rule that they installed, which is that any single member could move to oust the speaker. So Marjorie Taylor Greene took out the papers and began the process of filing them right before we left. And sometimes it sounds like she's determined and hell-bent to do it. Other times she's saying she'll give him a chance. But you see, what's happening is that whether it's Chip Roy or it's Marjorie Taylor Greene, who my colleagues call perjury traitor queen, but I don't call that. But
there's a word for that, paralepsis. I mean, I'm not saying she's, yeah, but yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Where my friend Lauren Boebert, who they call Lauren Groper, but not me.
But not you.
Not me. But anyway, I mean, whichever one has the power to try to vacate the chair. And what that means is that, of course, the speaker has no functional governing apparatus or cadence or machinery to move forward, because anybody can just blow the whole thing up. But it's great for Donald Trump because he really controls a couple dozen of them. So he just gets on the phone and then he can block anything that he wants to. But it's not a governing party and it's not a pro-constitutional democracy party. And so the right way to understand it is that he's in league with Putin and Orban and el-Sisi and Erdogan and Xi and, you know, the homicidal crown prince of Saudi Arabia and the dictator in pajamas from North Korea. I mean, you know, basically that's his team. And so he's stepped outside of the constitutional system. The political scientists say that the hallmarks of a fascist political party are that they don't accept the results of democratic elections that don't go their way. They embrace or they refuse to disavow political violence as an instrument for obtaining and maintaining political power. And they're organized as a cult of personality around a charismatic or allegedly charismatic figure. They elevate that person's word above the rule of law and above the Constitution. So I would love to hear a little more detail from Christine about her forward party, but I hope that that's not a political party that's going to be fielding a candidate for president in 2024, adding to the din of, Bobby Kennedy Jr. and Cornel West and everybody.
No, we're definitely not fielding a presidential candidate. What we are working on, though, is we'll support a Republican, a Democrat, an independent, as long as they will sign our pledge and we vet them carefully to make sure that they are committed to this. And what we're working on is the reverse coattails, in that people are not going to want to go to the polls because they don't like their choices at the top. But if they have a mayoral league candidate, a school board candidate, a local assembly candidate, or a candidate for a state office that they like, they will go and vote for them. And then history has shown us that once they are at the polls, they will stay on the ballot and look for similar centrist type candidates. Because if they're forward, they're centrist. I mean, they agree. They want to solve problems. The whole reason for getting into office is to solve problems and to make things better. Shocking, but that's what we're looking for.
I would try to make a pitch for Christine and her compadres there to join the Democratic Party, at least at the national level, which I think is a forward party. I sat there for 4 years under Donald Trump. We had an infrastructure day. We had an infrastructure week. We had infrastructure month. We just never had an infrastructure bill. But under Biden, we got it in the first week and we passed a $1.5 trillion plan for the bridges and the roads and the highways and the ports and the airports and rural broadband. And we passed the Inflation Reduction Act, which was the greatest investment in clean, renewable energy to supplant the greenhouse gas emissions. And we also lowered inflation and we also lowered dramatically people's prescription drug care costs, in the Medicare program while reducing the costs of Medicare generally, simply by allowing the market principle to operate and to have the government negotiate with big pharma for low prices.
I would push back just a little because there are 500,000 elective offices across the country. And in any given year, 70% of them, there's only one candidate. And of those, 5 to 12% are never filled. Our position is we need a third party. We need a third party to hold the two accountable and to ensure that every voter has a choice. We haven't done well. If you look around in states, when you have one party rule, it doesn't work so well for the people in those states. That's why we're not Democratic, even though, as you say, you've been able to accomplish a lot more than what we've seen coming from the Republicans at the moment. But we're going to stay with the idea that we need to keep both parties feet to the fire by having an alternative that forces campaigns and gives people a choice, particularly at the local level.
Well, I was just going to say there's nothing inherently wrong with having a third party. But if you look at American history, the third parties have only been successful by proxy, as it were. Their influence ends up being through one of the two major parties. You know, the founding fathers didn't want parties at all, but they got them. And there was something about the way our system was designed that caused it to gravitate to a two-party system. And that system has had tremendous hold. Now, it's entirely possible that a party, the Forward Party, could replace the Republican Party. That would be a wonderful development. But what I think is very unlikely is that the American system evolves in a way that makes a third party a viable contender while one of the two existing parties is still in serious play.
It's a challenge because the state officials will do everything they can to keep us off the ballot. But the difference is that most of the third parties we've had in the past have been at the presidential level and around either one sort of set of issues like the Green Party or one person like Perot. We're building that infrastructure. We're on the ballot now as a recognized party in five states, and we're working to get on the ballot in others. And for instance, in their states where if you get 2% of the vote, if you run a statewide candidate and get 2% of the vote, you then become a party forever in that state. So there are some races where we know we probably won't win, but we also know we'll get better than 2%. It's the long term. It's not going to happen overnight, believe me. And we're all in it for the long run.
Ironically, Professor Raskin could tell us this, but I think that's closer to the vision that the founders had. Our sort of very concretized two-party system has had a lot of implications, including in the impeachments.
I'm a little more optimistic, I think, than Jacob is about third parties in American history. We've had a lot of third parties that have played a meaningful role in changing things, including the Republican Party, which became a major party. But also, you know, the Socialist Party, the Progressive Party, the Greenback Party. A lot of it is an artifact of the electoral arrangements that are in place. So when fusion politics was allowed in the electoral system and people could be cross-endorsed mm-hmm. on the ballot or could be listed with several political parties, then the third or the multiple parties had a lot more traction. And so a lot of it is just an artifact of what are the electoral rules in place and to what extent will the court vigorously enforce their rights. I mean, I agree completely with Christine. I think competition is great in economics and great in sports, and it's great in politics. And we should not allow a monopoly party or a duopoly system exclude new entrants into politics. And so I'm often persona non grata in my party because I'm totally opposed to like these absurd signature requirements where you've got to get 87,000 signatures with name, address, ward, precinct, zip code, and you leave one thing off and then the signature's disqualified. In some states, you just need one signature, which is the candidate's signature. But there have been lots of barriers to entry that have been erected, and that's wrong. And the last thing I want to say is a lot of these one-party states are Republican states. I mean, we don't have any Democratic representation from Wyoming, from Utah, from North Dakota today, from South Dakota. That's really bad when you don't have any party diversity within a congressional delegation for a lot of reasons. And so to the extent that your effort could help to break that up and create a fusion ticket or coalition ticket among the out parties, I'm all for that.
All right, one point and then a closeout question. The point is just the dynamic you're talking about with Trump and what you've just mentioned, Congressman. might change. I mean, a lot of wise people see the election coming down to a very small number of folks in about six states who are not paying attention yet and query if and when they do whether the kind of debased form of politics that Trump is playing turns out to actually alienate and take numbers from the margin in a way that we don't know yet. My question is this, it's for everyone, even though it's about the Democrats. So as I understand it, the Dems pretty much have to run the table, even though you would think their prospects are pretty good in the House. What's anyone's sense, you know, clear-eyed sense of the prospects for a changeover in the House in November?
On the House side, I feel increasingly confident that we are going to take back the House, and I'm going to a lot of the swing districts. Some of them are in California, Harry, like the Will Rollins district in Southern California. We already took back the 3rd district in New York, which is Swazi's district. Santos was a visitor from outer space for a year or so there. But there are a couple other districts in New York that we're going to be able to get. There's a new district in Alabama we're going to get that was miraculously created through meaningful Voting Rights Act enforcement. I think that there could be another one in Louisiana. And now we've, you know, lost some ground in North Carolina through a terrible gerrymander. But look, aside from...
This just been upheld, right? That's going to be the in place for the election. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's going to hurt us. We're going to lose 3 seats there, including my cousin, Kathy Manning, who's been a really strong member. But beyond all of that, I think that there will be a rising tide as the public zeroes in on the fact that this has been an historic do-nothing Congress. I mean, it's just appalling. One of the things we do on the Oversight Committee is postal renamings or namings, and they can't even pass postal bills now because Congresswoman Anna Luna, you can complete her last name for her, Anna Luna objected. This has been a bipartisan, unanimous consent process forever. And we had a package of postal bills we brought to the committee, and she blew it all up because she was upset about something taking place in Florida. And I said, look, I'm warning you guys right now. I'm going to go out to the country, and I'm going to tell them, not only can you not pass a foreign assistance package or an immigration bill, much less anything to improve the economy or invest in the infrastructure, you guys can't even do postal namings anymore.
Congressman, what sort of woke left-wing heroes were you trying to name post offices after?
Right. Well, actually, it wasn't about that. What it was about was she's in some kind of feud with Debbie Wasserman Schultz in Florida. So she's decided to escalate the feud from Florida to the whole country. It's curious you mentioned that, Jacob, because in that process, they are sabotaging a bunch of very worthy postal namings, including one by my friend Jennifer Wexton, who's very ill, you know, and she has wanted to name a post office after Madeleine Albright, who's a hero to her. Mm-hmm. And not only did Anna Luna decide to blow up the process over a petty feud that she's engaged in with Debbie Wasserman Schultz, then Scott Perry, the pro-insurrectionist MAGA Republican from Pennsylvania, decided to weigh in against the naming of a post office by my colleague Jennifer Wexton for Madeleine Albright because he doesn't like the position that she took on COVID-19. And I said, wait a second, right now you're going to really destroy the entire process because traditionally the process has been if you can get the assent of everybody in your state delegation, Democrat and Republican, everybody else would let it through. Now he wants to second guess the judgment, not just of the Democrats in Virginia, but the Republicans in Virginia.
All right. We are way down in the weeds. But when you're fighting over post offices with Deborah Wasserman Schultz, just final thoughts about the broad shape and the prospects, not at the presidential level, for things looking different. Do you see it as very fluid or the basic building blocks favoring one or another?
The Democrats are smart and able to really build a narrative around abortion. I think that's going to bring out a lot of women. What's interesting in what we're seeing today is the split is not so much between younger people and between men and women. Men seem to be supporting Trump. I mean, you want to say this guy doesn't like any of you. He would never sit down and have even a beer with you. He probably would drink something else. But I mean, he's not your friend. But there are, unfortunately, I know a lot of very well-to-do people who who still support him because they're hopeful of tax breaks. And you want to say, I get it. I understand bottom lines. I understand the regulatory burdens that organizations and agencies like my old one can put in. But you really want to blow up our democracy for that? And I really think our democracy is hanging by a thread right now. It's on the ballot. And everybody thinks that's overly dramatic to say it. But we've had rough times before. We've had the Civil War. We've had horrible things go on in the country. But we've never had an ex-president. And by the way, I wish everybody would say ex, because that means he lost. Former is for people who left the office on their own. But ex is when they lost an election. So, and I know it would drive him nuts if you called him ex.
The ex-president.
He's very sensitive, you know, the ex-president. But we've never had an ex-president that has shown such disregard for the Constitution and the rule of law. And that's just scary to me as we look going forward to this next election. The good news, I will say, though, we found in States United last cycle, and we're nonpartisan, nonpolitical at all. We just look at facts. And when we looked at facts of the where there was an election denier running and just made that available to the public, not saying good, bad, or indifferent, just know this, their popularity went down 20%, which is anybody in politics will tell you is a huge amount. So getting that kind of information out about where these candidates really stand and some of the crazier theories that are out there can help. So I think there is hope. And if the Democrats can really focus on women who are losing their right to control their own bodies, that's going to drive a lot of women to the polls.
Well, I was just going to say that question of how you turn out. If Biden is reelected, how will it have happened? I don't think it's going to have been based on Biden's personal appeal or enthusiasm about Biden. I don't think it's going to be based on his very strong record of accomplishment. I think it's going to be based on fear of Trump, appropriately so, and what Governor Whitman just said, what helped the Democrats perform so strongly in the midterm, where abortion is on the ballot or where people see abortion as threatened. That and a few other issues may get people to the polls in the way that you would normally look to the candidate at the head of the ticket to get people to the polls.
All right. And speaking of abortion and it still playing a role, I had a couple of things I wanted to mention about the Supreme Court, but maybe we can talk about the Mifepristone case. So this is the first abortion case the justices have had since overruling Roe versus Wade. Just for starters, I would say that the intense focus on it did show that it's still very much a motivating issue. But it did seem to me that the court was looking toward going the way of dismissing the challenge based on standing.
I think that the country is now viewing itself as half free choice and half theocrat, or I guess in the terms of MAGA, half pro-life, half pro-choice. But Lincoln said that couldn't stand, half slave and half free. And I don't think it can stand. And the vast majority of people, as we saw in Kansas, as we saw in Ohio, as we've seen in lots of other conservative places, and anywhere it's in the ballot, rejects the right-wing MAGA GOP position on this. Now, for my first 5 or 6 years in Congress, all we heard was abortion is murder, abortion is genocide, Donald Trump saying women should go to jail, this is a crime, and so on. The cat's got their tongue now, no doubt, because they've been seeing what's happening at the polls. But that is their position, and they're locked in with all of the right-wing anti-choice groups. The Mifepristone case is not going to change by one iota the basic political dynamics around the choice issue. And understand that abortion is now not just about abortion. Abortion is about freedom and whether people can lead their own lives. Would you rather have state legislators controlling your reproductive destiny and your family life, or women and their partners and their doctors and their, you know, and it's not even close when you get to it. So it's about freedom, but it's also about equal rights for women, and whether women will be forced to sit in the backseat of a car for 6 hours until they've hemorrhaged enough that a doctor won't be afraid to see them anymore. And people understand now what it's really about. So I think that the politicians, including the Republicans, are fleeing as fast as they can from that position. But the Republican Party as an entity is locked in. And Mike Johnson's name is on the Life Begins at Conception Act with 150 other members. So the relevant question for people trying to decide who to vote for is going to be, will this person vote with the Democrats to reinscribe Roe versus Wade into the law? And either you're going to vote for that or you're not going to vote for that. And that's the critical question.
Post-Dobbs, there are Republicans pushing positions on reproductive rights that are far more unpopular than Roe v. Wade is a split. But when it comes to pharmaceutical abortion, early abortions with mifepristone, there is much more support for them. IVF is an issue. They're getting onto a narrower and narrower spit of land where fewer and fewer people support them. And I think it's politically really damaging to them. I mean, in this case this week, Justice Alito was asking the Solicitor General why they weren't applying the Comstock Act. The Comstock Act is a law from the era of the Grant administration, I'm not mistaken, that said doctors could be sentenced to terms of hard labor for supplying information about contraception. And it's one of these zombie laws that's been, essentially invalidated constitutionally, but still on the books. And theoretically, if President Trump could try to apply it, and if he has a congenial court, maybe he'd get away with it.
Oh, yeah.
But the Comstock Act is not going to be 40 or 45% popular with Republicans. It's going to be, 10 to 15% popular. So I just think politically they've painted themselves into a terrible corner.
I would agree with that. And the thing about the court was interesting in the arguments on the recent case. You had the women, even the most conservative ones, actually pushing and asking some questions. They were finally seeing it as, it's my body. We're really talking about real people here. I don't think, because I'm with you, I believe that they will probably dismiss it on standing, which doesn't take the issue away at all. And so it's still there. It's still going to be a big issue. And you have such an activist court on this. I have never seen a court that has reached down the way this court has to find cases that they can bring up, but not even ripe for them, but that they can bring up to pursue an ideological agenda. And that ideological agenda from certainly Clarence Thomas, he never wrote an opinion. He never said a thing until it started to get into women's rights to control their own bodies. Nobody's pro-abortion. We're pro a woman's right to choose. I'm pro-life. I've got 7 grandkids. I love them all. I'm glad I have 7 grandchildren. It's just ridiculous to pose it that way. But that's how it got done early on. And neither side was particularly smart on how they positioned themselves or how they talked about it. And so now it's coming home to roost. And I agree that the Republicans can't get out from under this. And I don't think it's going to go away, no matter what this decision is.
Let's stick with the court for a second. This week, no less a firebrand than Liz Cheney admonished the court about the immunity appeal in a speech at Drake University. She said it cannot be the case that a president of the United States can attempt to overturn an election and seize power, and that our justice system is incapable of holding a trial. And she said the delay, and they have a somewhat leisurely schedule on the immunity issue, amounts to suppression of the evidence against Trump. So, I just wondered your thoughts about it and also how it's sort of played. She's obviously considered a solid conservative, but that's quite a charge, actually suggesting that not moving more quickly is what? A dereliction of their constitutional responsibility, yeah?
Why they even took the case? The appellate decision was very tightly written and it was a unanimous decision. And so that's what scares me. The fact that they took it at all makes me worry that they are going to somehow say, this guy is not guilty of anything. I think for all of us that have been in public office, you take an oath, and that means something. The oath is to uphold the Constitution and the rule of law. And clearly, Donald Trump did not do that. It's not a question of free speech and anything he's allowed to say as president. This was inciting to riot. He said he wanted to go up with them. The only reason he couldn't go is because his security wouldn't let him. He was going to lead it up there. You can't look away from those things.
I agree completely with Christina about that. I disagree a tiny bit with my friend Liz Cheney, because it's not suppression of evidence. After all, it's not the Supreme Court's role constitutionally to let the people see the character of Donald Trump before the election. But in some sense, it's worse than suppression of the evidence. It's interference with the proper course of the trial, because that trial was on a schedule where it would have been heard and people would have been able to see what was going on. But the trial judge in the case, Judge Chutkin, had set a reasonable trial for speedy justice and just getting it done. And the Supreme Court threw a complete monkey wrench into the process. So they might come back with an opinion as good as the one in the D.C. Circuit. I doubt it, but they'll probably reject most of Donald Trump's ludicrous claims.
It won't be unanimous, I'll bet.
It won't be unanimous. But in any event, what they will have succeeded in doing is making it impossible for that trial to go forward. And that trial would have had the additional byproduct, I think, that Liz Cheney's looking for. Like, let's get a ruling on what happened on January 6th and on the relevant criminal offenses. Our committee, the January 6th Select Committee, we referred charges. That was my job. I was chairing that subcommittee. We referred charges to the Department of Justice. They took some. They didn't take others. And I think Liz is very eager for the public to see it. But in a political sense, I just want to make one final point, which is I think that Donald Trump's people know what he's all about, what his character is, and that he stands outside of the constitutional system and would tear it down. I think our people know the same thing. There might be some people who are moved by a criminal conviction, but I think they should be equally moved now, and we should be doing everything we can to explain about his civil convictions. He's already been adjudicated a rapist. He's been adjudicated a defamer of a rape victim, his own rape victim. He's been adjudicated somebody who's engaged in banking fraud and insurance fraud in order to save himself hundreds of millions of dollars, which is why he's in debt $500 million now. So I don't want to blow the criminal trials up to such a big thing that we make more out of them than they are. Basically, we know who Donald Trump is. The real question this election is, who are we and what do we stand for?
It's sort of an acute presentation of the problem of justice delayed being justice denied, because it's, you know, there's no more basic question to American democracy than whether a president can be held accountable for crimes. Because if he can't, he's not a president, he's a king. But if in the instance where you have an ex-president, thank you, Governor Whitman, claiming that he is still a legitimate president, evading accountability until the next election, that is justice denied in full. Don't know why the Supreme Court is doing it. Doesn't seem to be in any way a close question. Now, if it's another month and you get the trial underway, the timing may not play out in the way people are worried about. It may not delay it until after the election. In fact, it may put it more squarely in the center of the election. Will it change anybody's mind? I don't know. There are these polls where people say, oh, if he were convicted of a criminal offense, it could affect their vote. It's sort of hard to imagine there's anybody who has not made up their mind to the extent that they're swayable there. I think maybe that's just something you say to pollsters because it sounds like something you should say. At the same time, I can't imagine that being on trial, various trials, the various trials you cite for months leading up to an election can possibly be helpful to anyone, even Donald Trump.
Well, he does love to strike the pose of the martyr.
Well, Jesus Christ is the new one. I'm not sure if you've seen his most recent video, but he has an image of a grayed out Jesus Christ sitting next to him in court.
I mean, it's so disgusting. He has a Bible he's giving out now.
Giving out, selling for
$59.95. $59.99, yeah.
I can't say it. It's going to be nasty.
It's now time to take a moment for our sidebar feature, which explains some of the issues and topics that are prominent in the news. Today's feature is about the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act, a bill designed to ensure that certain types of health plans cover mental health and substance use disorders no less generally than they cover physical health issues. And to explain this topic, we welcome Dr. Joy. Dr. Joy Harden Bradford is a licensed psychologist, founder, and CEO of Therapy for Black Girls, and host of its very popular mental health podcast, which received a Webby Award in 2023. She is also the author of the book Sisterhood Heals. Her work focuses on making mental health topics more accessible for Black women. And with that, I give you Dr. Joy on the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act.
Patients needing treatment for mental health and substance abuse have long faced a variety of obstacles, many tracing to a tendency in society to blame the patients or see their afflictions as less deserving of treatment. The Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act, which passed in 2008, is designed to address this problem. The act prevents much discrimination by health insurance providers against mental health-related costs. In particular, the act forbids large health plans from imposing annual or lifetime dollar limits on mental health benefits more restrictive than imposed on other medical or surgical benefits. The MHPAEA was designed to bolster a previous 1998 law that required parity of mental health benefits but included significant exceptions in coverage, for example, businesses with fewer than 50 employees. The previous act also permitted some of the costs to be offloaded on the patient through higher deductibles, and it provided no protection at all for healthcare costs related to substance abuse. The 2008 Act extended the parity requirements for mental health benefits to substance use disorders. It required that co-payments and deductibles for treatment for mental health and substance abuse must be on par with limitations for medical and surgical coverage. And through the operation of the Affordable Care Act, the MHPAEA applies to individual or small group plans. The new law is not a cure-all. Most glaringly, there is no requirement for insurance providers to include mental health services in the first place, and the goal of ensuring the parity of services has proven difficult in operation, given the ambiguities and complicated financial elements of health insurance plans. The Biden administration has called for new regulations and standards surrounding mental health care, last summer proposing a rule to fully protect the rights of people seeking mental health and substance use disorder benefits and provide clear guidance to insurers on compliance. We expect the final rule in the next few months. For now, the overall treatment regime and insurance coverage for mental health and substance abuse issues remain at less than full parity with other health care. For Talking Feds, I'm Dr. Joy Harden Bradford.
Thank you very much, Dr. Joy. You can listen to Dr. Joy's podcast, Therapy for Black Girls, on Spotify or Apple Podcasts.
All right, it is now time for a spirited debate brought to you by our sponsor, Total Wine and More. Each episode, you'll be hearing an expert talk about the pros and cons of a particular issue in the world of wine, spirit, and beverages.
Thank you, Harry. In today's spirited debate, we discuss adding the right amount of water to a glass of whiskey without turning it into a whiskey river. The thought of adding water to any golden brown whiskey might bring tears to the eyes of some whiskey drinkers. But for others, adding a few drops of water to your glass has its merits, and actually improves and enhances the flavor. The phrase open up refers to the release of the extra flavor you taste by adding those drops of water. And here's a little bit of science that helps reinforce that theory. When water is added to whiskey, it releases the guaiacol, which is partially responsible for the smoky and spicy flavor. When guaiacol is released, it rises to the surface so the aromas are more easily noticeable, allowing your palate to experience the smell and flavor that imparts on the drink. And while there's really no right or wrong way, some say adding a splash of water brings out the best in your glass of whiskey. Of course, going overboard with the water has diminishing returns, watering down the whiskey and proving once again that moderation almost always wins. So the next time you're thirsting for a little experimenting of your own, stop into your local Total Wine and More for a whiskey selection that suits every budget. And that's a scientific fact. So find what you love and love what you find. Only at Total Wine and More. Cheers!
Thanks to our friends at Total Wine and More for today's A Spirited Debate.
Look, I wanted to make one more legal point and then segue to a sort of closing question. The legal point is the danger here to me is if the court makes some ruling that doesn't apply to Trump, but says there are instances in which immunity doesn't apply in the criminal context, it will, I think, lead to a remand, and a remand, even though it's obvious that it wouldn't apply to him, could lead to another quicker, but still, 1 month, 6 week trip up and down, and now we're really in trouble on timing. I did want to talk about the Trump trials, but we're short on time, so let me just serve up basically the question that, Jacob, you were just asking, because there are these polls that seem to suggest again and again, a conviction is the one potential game changer. But we've seen, you know, game changers prospectively that didn't really change the game once they happened with Trump. And you hear other people saying it doesn't really matter. It's all up to the American people and the ballot box. So I actually wanted to ask, how much of your attention and faith are you putting in these trials overall? Are you really fastened onto them as important and pivotal, or basically as background noise?
Everyone loves a deus ex machina as a way to end the play. And, you know, we may, just because Trump's been incredibly lucky so far, doesn't mean, I'm not superstitious. I don't think he's inherently lucky. And I think these cases all present real hazards to him in different ways. The January 6th case is by far the most important. That's why I care about it the most. But I think there is hope that it'll change the game, but it'll be very foolish to count on those trials to drive the result we need, which is for Trump to lose. So we got to think about how Trump loses, even if we don't get him in court.
I would agree. I would say that it's not going to change it. I don't think we can count on it as being the game changer that people would like. Of course, if he gets hauled off to jail, that may be different, but his people are locked in and they're just going to demonstrate like mad and keep talking about how it's unfair and it's rigged and, you know, he really did nothing. One way or another, it's not going to be what we would like it to be or what it should be in the normal course of events. If you have a candidate who gets convicted of a crime or has as many charges out against him, you'd think that would be an automatic disqualifier. But unfortunately, we've seen that's not the case. And in fact, we have local level or congressional candidates who have things in their background that would normally have disqualified them, but doesn't seem to anymore.
And I'm not in the legal prognostication business. I'm in the political mobilization business, as you know, Ari. And I've been to 18 states, and I'm going out wherever my colleagues in the House or Senate need me. And for the Biden campaign, I fell out of love with the Supreme Court a long time ago. Talk about unfair and rigged. That's a great description of this Supreme Court, which has been utterly gerrymandered by Mitch McConnell and the Federalist Society and America's right wing. And so the fix is very much in on a whole bunch of different cases, and we'll have to deal with that problem later. But in the meantime, the vast majority of the American people reject right-wing authoritarianism. Biden beat Trump by more than 7 million votes in 2020. We've got more than 10 million new young voters coming onto the rolls in 2024. And that's where we need to go, is to organize and mobilize people to get out and vote. Make sure people's votes are counted over all of the voter suppression and election depression and gerrymandering and right-wing judicial activism tactics that they've got. We've just got to make sure that the majority is actually heard. And then we got to defend the results all the way up through January 6th, 2025. And then, you know, we can keep the country moving forward on the real problems of our days.
We're just about out of time. We just have a couple minutes for our final feature of Five Words or Fewer, in which we take a question by a viewer and each of us has to answer it in five words or fewer. And today's question is, Trump has sold $60 Bibles, $399 sneakers, and more since leaving office. What's next?
Rooms in the White House?
Rooms in the White House. Five words exactly.
Shares in Truth Social.
Exactly.
Painting Trump national gold.
Excellent. Fool's gold, Trump gold. And I'm going with cheeseburger and fries, only $50. That is it for our April 1st edition. Thank you so much, Governor Whitman, Congressman Raskin, and Jacob Weisberg. And thank you very much, listeners, for tuning in to Talking Feds. If you like what you've heard, please tell a friend to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever they get their podcasts. And please take a moment to rate and review this podcast. You can also subscribe to us on YouTube, where we post full episodes, talking books, and bonus video content. You can follow us on Twitter at Talking Feds Pod, and you can look to see our latest offerings on Patreon. Talking Feds is a completely independent production, so if you like the work we do and are inclined to support the show, joining our Patreon is the best way to do it. And you can now leave voicemails with your questions for me and our guests. Whether it's for Talking Five or general questions about the inner workings of the legal system for our sidebar segments, all you have to do is call 727-279-5339 and leave a voice message. That's 727-279-5339. And you can still also, of course, email us your questions at questions@talkingfeds.com. Thanks for tuning in, and don't worry. As long as you need answers, the feds will keep talking. Talking Feds is produced by Catherine Devine. Associate producer Meredith McCabe. Sound engineering by Matt McCardle. Our research producer is Zeke Reed. Rosie Don Griffin and David Lieberman are our contributing writers. Production assistance by Akshaj Turbailu, and our music by the amazing Philip Glass. Thanks very much to Dr. Joy for explaining the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act. This episode is dedicated to Daniel Kahneman, who died this week, a Promethean scholar who taught us so much about our own thinking and irrationality. Talking Feds is a production of DeLito LLC. I'm Harry Littman. Talk to you later.